Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this fourth podcast to mark the coming presidential election, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Altered States, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about how the power of the US president has been exercised since the Second World War.
Professor Black, the Second World War ends with the US economy not only vastly expanded from its pre-war depressive state, but with it as the dominant force in a war-shattered, divided world. And the US as a world power, whether by choice or by circumstance. But Harry S. Truman is a very different personality to his predecessor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What has the Second World War changed about the role and the expectation of the role of the American president?
Well, that's, again, a very interesting question, taking us up from where we were last time. I'm not sure that so much the Second World War uniquely had done so. Partly it's the problem that after the war, there isn't a return to pre-war normality, whatever you mean by normality, in the sense that the issues and problems posed by America being, as you point out, the great world power, and in particular by its anxieties about the Soviet Union, mean that its opportunity, the opportunity of the presidential system to revert to a more domestic pattern, which we'd seen in the 1920s, doesn't really recur. So that Truman, who, I mean, I happen to think Truman's a very impressive figure, but Truman, who essentially had, you know, risen as a, you know, very much a originally a machine politician from the Prendergast system at St. Louis, a Missouri senator. Shall we say, very much not a figure from the coast, not a East Coast patrician like Roosevelt. Truman finds that, and he rises to the challenge, he is the leading statesman in the free world. Bang, simple as that. And that he is instrumental in key decisions, whether we're thinking about the formation of NATO, the American commitment to the Korean War, all sorts of decisions which are primarily international in scope, but which obviously have consequences for America's engagement with, you know, wider geopolitics.
In the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, there's an intention of America to withdraw from Europe, and very quickly it finds it can't do that. How central do you see Truman's judgment in that, as distinct from that of Congress and a broader move, a broader sense of things amongst the wider American public?
Well, that's, again, an interesting question. I mean, personally, as I've said, I'm rather sympathetic to Truman. I think he's a very perceptive individual. And also, it's worth pointing out, rather like Churchill, he's somebody who had experience of conflict. I mean, so many figures in world geopolitics in the 20th century who sent people, and even more in recent decades, who sent troops into action had absolutely no idea what it entailed. Truman had, and he also had the very difficult practical, pragmatic, and ethical decision to make about the dropping of the atom bombs. So I don't think Truman was somebody who was shy of the problems. I so happen to think he was more perceptive, it wasn't always at once, but more perceptive than Roosevelt about the challenge that the Soviet Union posed to the international order. And I think because of that, he made a more impressive president. I mean, you know, I know everybody is constrained by circumstances, and the circumstances were not easy for Roosevelt. But as I argued last time, Roosevelt was an appeaser of Germany in the late 30s. Truman was not an appeaser of the Soviet Union in the late 40s.
This fight against communism, fighting against an ideology, that puts the post-war presidents in a very different prism to those of the 1920s or 1910s or the late 19th century. To what extent does the sense of being the leader of the free world fighting against an ideology shape the idealism in which the role of presidency is seen?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, first of all, can I just say, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say there's no ideological issues earlier. I mean, we did discuss last time the sense of anxiety in the early 1920s about what they referred to as Bolshevism. I think what I would say in the late 40s, early 50s is that this sense of anxiety is directly linked to the fact that as it were, the constraints on the Soviet Union that had been created in the 1920s, particularly by the Polish success in stopping the Soviet advance in 1920, etc., etc., that those constraints had ended and Soviet power reached from the Elbe to encompass Manchuria by in 1945. And I think in that context, the ideological challenge was more significant. Also, there's the experience that both the United States and the Soviet Union had had in 1941 of surprise attacks mounted on them, which had wreaked considerable damage and which had shown that the international order, however defined, was certainly not one that was predictable. So that in a way, there is the issue there after World War II. Now, Khrushchev famously said of Stalin that Stalin's idea of foreign policy was to keep the anti-aircraft batteries around Moscow ready at 24 hours for the continuous possibility of attack. And in a way, that requirement came to the fore for the Americans. There is this brief moment in which there is a degree of confidence that the United States, as the only power with atomic bombs, is in a position at a relatively modest cost to offer a deterrent, and that this is going to dissuade Soviets from pressing on. But in fact, that actually proves misguided. It proves misguided before the Soviets weaponized their own atomic weapons program, because already the Chinese Civil War of 1946-49 has shown that even if the Western system has atomic weaponry, this isn't necessarily going to mean that it is going to be able to achieve its foreign policy goals. And the Soviet sort of move into the ability to deliver through long-range bombers, subsequently through intercontinental missiles, atomic weaponry, means that illusion is completely shattered. And that, I think, does put an enormous problem on the United States, because whereas in 1941 a surprise attack had ultimately, tragic as it was, amounted to devastation for the Americans in Guam, the Philippines, and primarily Pearl Harbor, by 1951, or even more 1955, or even more 1960, it can mean, of course, by 1960, the possibility of hydrogen bombs landing on New York and Chicago. And that does involve a very significant change in the situation.
I'm wondering how this role of the US president as the leader of the free world, combined with jet technology, which allows him to engage in summit diplomacy and so on, I wonder how that puts new pressures on the role of president, on the time that has to be spent talking to foreign powers, meeting with foreign powers, building the NATO alliance, and so on. Does this distract presidents, not just Truman, but Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, from what might have been the more traditional tasks of a US president before the Second World War?
Well, I certainly think that's the case, yes. There are several caveats we can enter. First of all, the United States is the chief player in the system, so people are more likely to go to Washington than the American president had to go anywhere else. And as far as the late 40s, 50s are concerned, there isn't yet the multitude of international institutions which develop, which require even more time. There is also technology initially in the shape of the telephone, which enables long-distance communication. So, yes, to a certain extent, but if you look at Truman's timetable and Eisenhower's timetable, whilst they travel, I mean, Eisenhower goes, you know, for example, to Geneva, they are not traveling as much as you might anticipate, and you've always got other people you can send. I mean, Eisenhower, for example, sends Richard Nixon to Moscow, sends Richard Nixon to Latin America, and Richard Nixon to the vice president, and so on and so forth. So I think that during, as it were, the acme of American power, which is the 1950s, the president isn't having to travel as widely as it might be the case with more recent presidents taking part in a much more, in some respects, much more complex and multifaceted international situation. As far as your other point about them not having to not being able to devote as much time to domestic policy, I agree with you entirely. I mean, the president not only is responsible for foreign policy, but they're also commander-in-chief, and I think that's a very important point. As commander-in-chief, it is very necessary for the president to take certain roles, to be seen by the military, to be committed to them, and also, of course, there is the development from the 1940s of what we might call, I'm not using this as a critical term, the national security state. In other words, a much more concerned process, first with the OSS, then the CIA, and then a number of other agencies concerned with intelligence assessment of the outside world, and in which ultimately those focus on the president. So I would argue that the degree of commitment that has to be shown to foreign affairs in the broadest sense becomes much more significant and as such, totally different to the situation, shall we say, in the late 20s and even more, shall we say, in the late 1880s.
Well, to me, one of the interesting things about what you called a moment ago the acme of American power in the 1950s is that the commander-in-chief is a former soldier, Dwight D. Eisenhower. How significant do you feel having Eisenhower with his soldier's perspective, how significant was that in the White House shaping where the focus of its attention is?
Eisenhower, I think, is a very impressive man. He has a great perception about the what power can achieve, but also what it can't achieve. And as you know, he's not a rollback politician. He is cautious, for example, in the Hungary crisis of 1956. He makes the point to Malenkov in 1955 at Geneva that it is entirely possible that if they get things wrong, human life in the Northern Hemisphere could be wiped out. And he's thinking there about the move from atom bombs, which are relatively, they're not demographically going to wipe out the species, to thermonuclear weaponry, hydrogen bombs, which have a completely different capacity. And he understands that. He also understands that power can be multivalent. For example, that it might be appropriate to use what we now would call hybrid warfare, or whatever phrase you wish to use. It's often termed the CIA, but it's actually generally broader than that, which they do, of course, in Guatemala, and they do in Iran in the 1950s, and indeed in other places. So, the fact that he is concerned about war war doesn't mean that he isn't willing to use force. And indeed, you might say the very same thing about Truman dropping the atom bombs. The very fact that Truman knew what war was like, having served on the Western Front in 1918, helps to underline his determination to bring it to a close in 1945. So I think Eisenhower is impressive and, of course, is also willing to use force for domestic purposes, sending in the airborne division into Little Rock in Arkansas during the civil rights agitation in order, in the case of Little Rock, it's against the anti-civil rights agitation on the part of the governor there, was inherently a contentious step. I mean, it's a reversal of the withdrawal of federal troops from the South in the 1870s, and it's no surprise that it's a Republican president that uses this. I mean, it is the party of Abraham Lincoln that uses the threat of force in order to overawe the National Guard. And, you know, it's worth bearing in mind, linked to that, as we were discussing last time, that despite the attempt, these days to always sanitize FDR, FDR's party was, as I mentioned with Woodrow Wilson, more racist than the Republicans. So Eisenhower has a lot to offer the United States, and I think myself that he makes a very good president, and I think it was crucially important during that stage of the Cold War to have him there. Now, let me make this clear. This does not mean that military figures are inherently preferable. I mean, another general, Douglas MacArthur, wished to be selected by the Republicans in 1952. And it's jolly good thing that the Republicans did not choose Douglas MacArthur in 52, because, to put it mildly, I think the degree of unpredictability and megalomania and willfulness bound up in MacArthur would have made him probably the most dire president of the 20th century. And equally, there were some other figures on the Republican side who were isolationist. So I think the Republicans ended up with a very good candidate in Eisenhower. And, of course, he was very fortunate that the Democrats did not produce so impressive a character, albeit somebody who was more established in the domestic political world. And it's so often the case, if you're looking at American presidents and making judgments about whether you think they are, whatever we mean by good or bad, you have to consider the choice the electors had. And I think in 52, not only that Eisenhower was impressive, but also he was the better choice.
And when we get to John F. Kennedy, new leadership for the 60s, is this a conscious attempt, not a rejection, but a constant attempt to move on from that post-war generation? Does John F. Kennedy bring a real new zing to the White House, or are we looking perhaps too much at the spin and presentation?
I think you are looking a bit at the spin and presentation. I mean, in some respects, it's old money politics, isn't it? His father bought him the presidency with bribery in Texas and Illinois. So if that's zing of money politics, I'm not sure. No, I mean, Kennedy himself was, in some respects, it's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing for his family what happened to him. But in some respects, I mean, his reputation was made by the fact he was A, young, and then B, assassinated. So died young, which is the classic way to maintain your reputation. I mean, he had some pretty noxious ideas. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that in terms of his foreign policy, he was very much linked to circles around the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, who was a pretty unappealing character, and I think helps to explain Kennedy's, if you like, Catholic foreign policy in the case of both Cuba and Vietnam, the interventionism in each case. And of course, he's incompetent in the Cuba one. As far as domestic policy is concerned, he's not doing brilliantly. I mean, that's why he has to go to Texas in 63 for the meeting that, alas, he gets killed on the route to. And it's by no means clear in 63 that he was going to win the 64 presidential election. Although, again, that a lot would depend upon who the Republicans put up against him. So, no, I think in domestic terms, he was less impressive than Johnson. And in international terms, he was less impressive than Eisenhower.
Well, in domestic terms, of course, as you say, Lyndon B. Johnson was a very major figure in the 20th century in America. Particularly, let's focus for a moment on the Great Society, particularly for those of our listeners in the UK who may not know so much about it. How would you describe the level of state intervention that the Great Society envisaged, and how important was it to increasing the role of the state in American society?
The important thing about Johnson in this respect is that he had, and in some respects he comes from a really impressive Texan schoolteacher kind of background, concerned with his fellow man. I mean, he was committed to betterment, and he understood social mobility to mean the improvement of the entire population, not just the enhancement of part of it. He declared of the blacks in 65, their cause must be our cause too. And indeed, one of the things that's deeply ironic about the current way in which civil rights is taken is that the key figures in civil rights were all white men. I mean, Truman for desegregating the military, Eisenhower for sending the troops into Little Rock, and Johnson for pushing through the Great Society. And obviously, that's not a theme that matches the modern sort of ideology. So that theme is downplayed. But Johnson had earlier supported desegregation in the Senate. He also saw it as a way to improve America's international reputation at a time of global competition with communism, and to end a potential route for communist subversion. And that's a theme that in part was his idea, but in part he drew on another key figure because of his anxiety about communist subversion, which is J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover argued that if they didn't do something to sort out the South, that it would end up with a situation where it might be the route for some kind of insurrection which would be exploited by the communists. And again, not exactly the sort of figure that you usually see when you're discussing civil rights today, but these were important people. Now, in order to do this, you needed somebody who was politically competent, and Johnson was able to isolate the Southern segregationists in Congress, and therefore that ensure that they didn't have the voting numbers to use filibustering in order to push things through. And that in turn rests in part on the extent to which moderate Republicans in Congress at that stage were unwilling to ally with the segregationists, the kind of Dixiecrats. So, you know, you're to see later under Nixon the Republicans to begin an alliance with the South. But Johnson, who is very eager to back the Civil Rights Act, which passes in 64, I think it is, he is really crucial as a congressional politician in being able to push that through. Now, hilariously, the segregationists called this federal oppression and argued that it was a resumption of the reconstruction of the 1860s and 70s. But, you know, to be blunt, I mean, if you're thinking about, let's say, the Chinese Cultural Revolution of the late 1960s, the idea that something equally brutal was going on in the United States is laughable.
Mm-hmm. So, this period, the period I'm now talking about, the 1960s and early 70s of Johnson and of Richard Nixon, is also a period of obviously the Vietnam War and of huge cultural ferment. To what extent does this earlier version of cultural wars shape the way in which presidents or presidential candidates align themselves on one or other side, and indeed the growth of Republican presidents as seen as being conservatives as well?
Right. Well, if I could mention one of my books where I've gone into that at some length, this culture wars in altered states, America since the 60s. So I'm only giving you now, shall we say, just one or two comments, because that's an enormously complex topic, not least because we're discussing America as an abstraction, whereas, as we mentioned, in the first program, it's a federation with, in some respects, what a Republican means in, let's say, or a Democrat means in Wisconsin is very different from what they mean in Alabama. And it's terribly easy to be misleadingly glib. So let's just try and make one or two comments here. Both the Republicans and the Democrats were coalitions. The Democrats more so than the Republicans during the early 20th century, because as we discussed last time, essentially and very crudely, you've got the Southern whites and you've got the big city immigrants, very crudely. The Republicans were not all, though, country club Republicans, Midwesterners, New York money, Rockefeller, etc., etc. There were always a variety of strands within Republicanism. And in the strain of the late 60s and 70s, and that strain is compounded of a whole host of things, relative economic problems, fiscal crisis, a sense of anxiety about order and peace in the cities, international failure, etc., etc. In that context, you get both the tensions within Republicanism, and indeed the same for the Democrats, becoming more apparent, but also tensions are a matter not just of, if you like to use the term, root ideology and or assumptions, but also a question of what we might call method. So in other words, people who can agree on a common goal might disagree on whether, for example, in the 72 election, you should chase votes that otherwise would have gone to the equivalent of George Wallace, or you might disagree as to whether, as a Republican, whether it's necessary to go off the in effect the gold standard, or necessary to introduce wages and prices control, or you should just see that as an expedient that doesn't tell you anything about broader intellectual and other assumptions. So you've got this tension here between, as we get in all politics, this tension between underlying goals, or if you want to use the phrase ideology, and the practicality of the moment. And the practicality of the moment becomes more intense for the Republicans when they come to power, just as it had been really intense for the Democrats in 67-68 as the Johnson presidency hits great problems. And then the question is how to respond to them. So you've got exactly the same with Nixon. And this brings out tensions within. Now, as you say, there are also then, though, at the same time, cultural issues. Now, let's be clear about this. Even at times that you might regard as benign and homogenous, and everybody always thinks the past is more benign and more homogenous than the present day, even at those times, there had been what you might choose to refer to as culture wars. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about divisions over evolution, for example, or over issues to do with gender or ethnicity, you can try growing up in some parts of the South earlier, but also you try discussing them in terms of the politics to do with the role of the Catholic Church in the big East Coast cities, or you try to discuss them in terms of somewhat small-mindedness of some of the Protestant communities. I mean, religion was very, very important, and it pushed people to some extent to the most basic of culture wars, which is the culture wars between different religions, and then also between those who were devout and those who, whether they were personally devout or not, did not think that that ought to dictate policies. And those, you could argue, and fundamental cultural wars earlier. What you get more in the case of the late 60s is the secularization of a lot of the debate around what we call culture or culture wars. And we've got to be careful about assuming this is simply the case of the United States, because as we know, in other countries, there are similar tensions, often dissimilar in the kind of alignments that arise or in the language used, but nevertheless similar tensions in those periods. And people glibly refer to the 1960s, when in fact, you know, probably more people went to church than ever took drugs in the 60s. But nevertheless, they are capturing with that phrase, the 60s, the sense that there was particularly in the late 60s, a reconceptualization by at least a portion of the population of some of the politics. Now, the interesting thing in the United States is there was quite a vigorous Republican conservative response to this. And indeed, again, that's part of the broader thing. You know, you get a lot of claptrap about how the 60s changed things. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the 60s, the leading election that comes in the late 60s is the American election in 1968, won by Nixon. The French presidential election is won by De Gaulle is succeeded by Pompidou. Mitterrand gets nowhere against either of them. And then in Britain in 1970, you get Edward Heath, that obvious epitome of 1960s values. I'm being sarcastic for non-Brits, you know, who comes through. So I think one's got to be very cautious about assuming that the 1960s transforms things. If anything, it encourages a degree of anxiety which leads in some quarters to a revival or a redefinition of aspects of conservative thought. And that starts a process with the Republicans, which you can see coming to greater fruition with the successive electoral victories in the presidential elections of 80, 84, and 88. All of which indicate that a lot of people were not happy with whatever the new democratic dispensation appeared to be.
And do you feel that Ronald Reagan's electoral successes in the 1980s can, to some extent, be explained by feeling that in the 70s, from Watergate onwards and the fall of Nixon through Ford's brief interregnum and then Jimmy Carter, America, the Vietnam War has gone wrong, recession has taken hold. There's a sense of the American Republic in decline.
Well, I think that's interesting. I mean, I think there was clearly a shift in the public mood. Reagan in 1980 wins 43.9 million votes. Carter wins 35.5. So, you know, that's a very significant significant gap. I mean, it's the biggest gap since Nixon's victory over McGovern in 72. It's a bigger gap, in other words, than the Carter victory in 76. And then Reagan goes on to do, you know, very significantly well. I can't remember off the top of my head the percentages, but in 84, I think it's even greater in 84 when he's up against Mondale. And in the 92 one, which I was actually in America during that campaign, Bush gets 54%, that's Bush Senior, 54% of the popular vote. So in other words, I think it's fair to say that there are significant mandates for the Republicans. I mean, bear in mind, most listeners aren't aware that when the Americans refer to a landslide is always less than 60% of the popular vote. So these are very significant majorities. And I think there was a sense of failure. I mean, in a way, this is unfair. Carter had done his best. And in fact, Carter, towards the end, did start on the reviving, if you like, of the American military and of the American strategic awareness. He realized that detente hadn't worked. He became anxious about what the Iranians were doing. He understood that the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan was serious. And whereas, you know, you get the standard left-wing discourse that it was all sort of Reagan who was a Cold War warrior. In fact, Carter, towards the end, was switching in the same direction, just as James Callaghan in Britain was a robust supporter of NATO. You didn't need to wait for Margaret Thatcher to have a robust politician in the late 1970s. But having said that, I think it's fair to say that Carter was associated with failure, and Reagan, in a way, therefore represents, and, you know, again, probably Americans, both Republicans and Democrats, won't want to hear this. Reagan, in a sense, is another Kennedy. He is somebody with whom, for whom the image is very important. This image about somebody who is new, somebody who can break with the past or the recent past, etc., etc., etc. And of course, in any system which is presidential, you have to want to believe in the leader. It's very difficult to run a political campaign saying, we're going to try and do our best, and we think we're a competent group, and we will hope that you will have the same view of us. Now, that's actually a pretty honest account, but you try it. I mean, it's not going to work. And it's not just politics, the same thing in business or any institution. The actual determination of the leader figure to promise a new outcome, to promise to do better, etc., etc. So in a way, Kennedy and Reagan both come from that hymn sheet. Those ideas are focused on them. Now, each incidentally suffers assassination attempts, in Reagan's case unsuccessfully so. And Reagan therefore has the opportunity to fulfill his two full terms. And there are both strengths and weaknesses of the Reagan system. But I think what one can fairly say is, alongside social issues, environmental pressures, etc., etc., I think one can say there's a degree of greater optimism in the 80s than there was in the 70s, and that is what helps him strongly to re-election in 84 and helps George H.W. Bush in 92, and in fact leads a number of Democrats to think that George H.W. Bush in 88, and leads a number of senior Democrats to think in 92 that Bush will win again. Of course, he doesn't. Clinton comes in. Now, one of the interesting things about this optimism is we can obviously put question marks about it. I mean, the Democrats do not help themselves by moving in American terms in what one might describe as a leftward direction. I mean, in many respects, for the Democrats to do best, it helps, or it helped for a period, we don't know at the present moment, but it helps if you have a Southern figure who can also appeal outside the South. So obviously that had been the case with Johnson in winning in 64. It had been the case with Carter in winning in 76. It's going to be the case with Clinton in winning in 92-96. And it nearly works for Gore in 2000. And the Democrats tend to not do so well when they have Northern figures who find it harder to make a that kind of more national impression. Now, you know, you can look at that in all sorts of different ways. But certainly, although I think the and of course, you know, the Democrats did put up Carter in 80 and he lost. So, you know, as with everything, one can qualify it. But I think in 84, Mondale was an unfortunate choice, just as I think McGovern had been an unfortunate choice in 72. And I think Dukakis in 88 was an unfortunate choice. I mean, Dukakis, in a way, was a sort of Hillary Clinton figure, except he'd actually worked harder at politics and, you know, knew more about how serving a constituency. But as a Massachusetts figure, he really found it hard to appeal more widely across the country as opposed to just on the coasts?
Well, I want to round off by asking a question which in some ways mirrors the where we started this podcast, and that is with the end of the Cold War and that period of euphoria, particularly the period between the end of the Cold War and success in the first Gulf War, George H.W. Bush speaking of a new world order. Has the role of the American president, particularly in foreign policy, but in terms of how it's viewed in the eye, as I come back to this term, you know, the leader of the free world, has the way in which that wider concept has been lost since the end of the Cold War really fractured or reshaped the way in which the presidents of the last 20 or 30 years have been able to operate within?
Well, I think we can look at specifics. I think that that a lot of the American public became disillusioned with what seemed to be intractable foreign commitments. And I think that tarnished, in particular, Bush Jr. And that was a result of not so much the fact that the Cold War has ended, but it was the result of failure, because the same had been seen during the Cold War period with the Vietnam War in and Johnson deciding not to run in 68. And you could argue that one of the factors that helped Eisenhower in 52 was the confidence that he could end the war, end the Korean War in that case. So I'm not sure it's just the end of the Cold War. I think that if you are in an intractable war that and you as a president become closely associated with it, that is something that is very difficult. And obviously, you know, it's very hard to distinguish between the counterfactuals at the moment, something we maybe ought to discuss. But you will notice that in the last election, President Trump made much of his determination that America should not get engaged in another war. And he used that, fairly or unfairly, we can discuss that, as a stick with which to beat Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton. So I think that there is a desire to actually be successful. I think that is a problem. I think that now that America is more engaged in international affairs than was the situation in the 19th century or for much of the first four decades of the 20th century, the possibility that it might find itself in an intractable conflict gets higher. And of course, an intractable conflict also destabilizes completely the finances, which is what happened to the United States with Vietnam, and it's arguably what happened as a result of Iraq. So there are many problems. Now, those aren't necessarily all visited back on the president or indeed on their party or indeed on Congress. You know, political blame can go all over the place or nowhere. But I think the situation is one's got to be very cautious of assuming that the president is necessarily a weaker candidate because America is not involved in the equivalent of the Cold War. And I would take this a stage further, and you know, maybe we can talk about some of this next week, although there is plenty else to talk about. I think that many of the particular characteristics of the way in which the American Constitution and political system has played out. There was nothing inevitable in how it played out. You know, people can look back to the late 18th century, the early days of the Republic. It's not inevitable how it would play out. But the extent to which the president is not really head of a political party that operates, shall we say, like a political party in Britain operates, has obvious consequences in terms of the relationship between the president and Congress. I don't think that has changed because of the end of the Cold War. I don't think the tensions in which America is, as it were, a continent pretending to be a country. In other words, what it means to be American in terms of your public culture is very different across this enormous area of over 330 million people. And many people might watch similar television programs, or identical television programs, or go to, you know, branded stores and eat McDonald's and all the rest of it. But that does not mean they are thinking the same ideas. So I think that that tension, I think, has got more difficult, because what I would argue, and if you really wanted to look at a major change in the last 60 years, and I tried to tease it out in my book, because, you know, I'm interested in geographical and factors. I argued in my book that if you looked at America in 1960, it was very much dominated by the East Coast as far west as Chicago. And I would suggest to you that you have had since a much more multi-centered United States. With the political revival of the South, the specific importance economically as well as politically, but particularly economically, of Texas, the rise and to a degree fall of California, but you've got a very different United States now in geographical terms and with the economic consequences of that. And I'd say that poses problems and issues for presidents of whichever political party, and indeed for congressional leaders, trying to put together the coalition of interests that is necessary in order to advance policy. So, yes, the international situation is significant, but I think, and you know, you might say this is ridiculous for me as an author of many works on warfare and international relations, but I do think there can be a tendency to underplay the domestic significance of American politics when you are looking at the fate of individual presidents and of the presidency as a whole.
Well, on that note about the importance of domestic politics, we must leave it there for this week. Professor Jeremy Black, author of Altered States, thank you very much for taking us through this panorama of 70 years of US presidents.
Can I just say something, if possible? Listeners may not be aware, none of this is pre-scripted. I don't know the questions, but equally, we therefore don't have any agenda. So if listeners want, we had initially been only going to do three of these. This, I think, is the fourth. I hope I'm right, Graham. I'm quite happy to do two more, one on the most recent period of the American presidency and then one looking back over the entire period of the presidency and discussing that. So maybe if listeners are interested, they should get in touch with Graham and let him know.
Please do. Please do. We will do that and we will act upon it. Professor Black, thank you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.